Advancements in ag research and technology not only help farmers produce more with less, but also have had a big impact on their ability to build healthier soils.
I can't farm the way I farm today if I had the same tools I had in the 80s. So what's allowing me this flexibility is the chemistries that we have, the fertilizers that we have, the equipment that we have. You know, on the AgriCenter research plot last year, we flew fungicide with the drone over our corn crop. I mean, I don't know if I would have said that 5 years ago. I don't know if I'd have even would have known to have said that 5 years ago. So it's a pretty cool space. You know, we're evolving significantly.
John Butler shares his experiences as a fifth-generation family farmer who now runs AgriCenter International, a 1,000-acre urban farm in Memphis, Tennessee that conducts research and hosts over a million visitors every year. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning in to Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hammerich. Joining me, of course, is our co-host, Dr. Abby Wick. And we're sitting down today with Tennessee farmer and CEO of AgriCenter International, John Butler. AgriCenter International, if you haven't heard about it, and I hadn't, so this is really, really cool, was founded in 1979 as a joint effort between Shelby County there in Memphis and the state of Tennessee, which set aside 1,000 acres to operate an urban farm. Today, the nonprofit organization is an education, agribusiness, research, and agricultural hub for the Mid-South. They have over 1.3 million visitors annually and partner with around 80 companies every year to conduct research, which includes over 20,000 replicated plots on around 700 acres of land. The breadth and scale of this organization is impressive enough, but also the diversity is remarkable, including several different row crops, specialty crops, tree crops, and a wide range of new products and growing practices. John Butler is the CEO and a fifth-generation farmer himself from northwestern Tennessee. Before joining AgriCenter International about 7 years ago, he was working on his family farm for about 25 years and had a career with Cargill, where he worked across multiple geographies in North America. John shares his unique perspective today as someone who worked in agribusiness, operated a more traditional farm, and now is running this urban farm and research hub. We talk about soil health, how they adapt principles to their local context there in the Mississippi Delta region, the impact of these research and education efforts, new technologies, and a whole lot more. First, John's going to start off our conversation talking about AgriCenter International and his transition to CEO of that organization from his previous full-time job on the family farm.
Together, between two different nonprofits, there's two different organizations that manage a 4,500-acre grain space right in the middle of Shelby County. And it's one of the neatest, I think, organizations in the country. And so we do everything from a 5,000-seat equine campus to a farmer's market to one of the coolest research organizations in the country. We have a 100,000 square foot of flex space. We use a mid-market kind of event venue, and we'll host about 1.5 million people to the campus annually and have about 100,000 cars that drive by the farm every day. So we are in the city.
And what was that transition like going from your family's farm to this operation? You know, how did you need to kind of rewire your own mindset with the big context shift there?
Well, so unfortunately, one of the things we learn in the ag sector, especially those of us that get our hands dirty and are involved in, you know, working the land and working with animals, is that, you know, we're committed to that effort 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's our life. The most challenging thing I found was stepping out of that role that I had done for almost 25 years. But the reason why I stepped out was to let the next generation in. And my father and mother did the same thing for me. So they let me come into the family business at a fairly young age. I was in my late 20s. So it was a unique opportunity. you know, because of some health situation my father was dealing with at the time, I was able to transition back to the farm. I never thought I would end up back on the farm. So I got that gift, so to speak. And, you know, I was able to help that next generation, the sixth generation, transition to the farm. And so our family business is important to me, like it is with any farmer or rancher. Every guy or gal that works the land and is committed to that, like I mentioned earlier. It was almost like a death in the family, the actual transition. My wife still laughs at me a little bit, you know. So I'm through the mourning phase and, you know, I'm back up and going again. But, you know, those of us that have done that work, it's never not a part of you, you know, just because of the commitment.
Oh, I'd love to follow some of maybe what you were doing on your family farm for 25 years into then what you're doing at AgriCenter. So maybe if we can go back to like your time on the family farm, what were some of the, you know, were you into soil health at that time? Or what was your journey like while you were farming?
Yeah, so I'll go back to the early 80s. I watched my father and grandfather over the course of about 5 years change their whole business model. So I got to tell you a little bit of the backstory. If you know a lot of farmers, you know we love telling stories. And so we grew up, you know, my family farm is in northwestern Tennessee. So it's a little bit the northern fringe of the Mississippi Delta. So we have some flat land, but we also have some highly erodible land. And it was really that change started on that highly erodible land. So it's very fertile soil, but it's very prone to erosion. And so I think it really dawned on my grandfather and my father as they were managing those resources and they saw what, you know, erosion was doing to the farm. They decided to make a change. And they called it at the time, you know, and all these conversations was, you know, farming ugly. But that really wasn't the reality of it. What the reality was is that we were farming the way we should have been farming, you know. And I think I've earned the right to say that because I followed that practice for over 25 years. So, and I'm still actively engaged in the management of the family business, just not the day-to-day operation of the family business. So what I mean by that is we were doing cover crop and no-till in the mid to late 80s, mostly because we had a great partner with the University of Tennessee, our land-grant university here in the state. They really moved no-till out of a conversation and into practice during that time frame. And so with the support of, you know, our land-grant university, you know, farmers and ranchers all over, you know, America make these changes in their practices. And you know, they do different things, whether it's integrated pest management or whether it's actually going from, you know, conventional till to no-till or minimum till. I would say right now, from the state of Tennessee's perspective, probably 85% of the farms that are being managed from a row crop perspective are practicing either minimum till or no-till. Almost 100% of the farms in my part of the country are no-till or minimum till. And that's just for the primary purpose of controlling erosion. What was very interesting is my father didn't stop there. So as he transitioned over to the manager in the late 80s, he started experimenting with cover crops. And so I still remember the first cover crop that I saw. I remember pulling a planter through that cover crop. I remember all the challenges we had with termination. And, you know, we didn't have all the tools in our toolbox that we have now. So a lot of the experiences that people went through 20 and 30 years ago with cover crops, I think we've got so many more tools in our toolbox. And then very quickly, you know, we've learned how to integrate, you know, different practices, whether it's grazing management or mechanical termination of cover crops, or even understanding the value of different mixes of cover crops, whether we plant in legumes or, you know, rye or tillage radishes. And so I love how we've evolved as an industry. And I also love the fact that our farms are no longer, you know, washing away on us. So just from a personal standpoint, I feel like my number one priority in being a good manager of natural resources is to make sure that stewardship is, you know, exhibited through, you know, water quality, you know, air quality, and then the enhancement of our farms and soils. So I think any farmer would feel that same passion. Every farmer I've ever met is 100% committed into passing on that legacy, being the best steward they can.
I'm curious if soil health was part of AgriCenter before you got there, or if it's something that you've really added to that organization.
No, I mean, we were doing a lot of soil health profile, understanding what commodities look like behind different practices for cover crops. But I think obviously it's been a focus of mine and something I've been involved with for years. And then what's interesting is before I moved back to the farm, I got to live in different parts of the country. And so I was very blessed to move around and basically lived in every region. So I got to live in upstate New York, and I saw what the dairy industry looked like there. I got to live in Minnesota, and I got to see, you know, what sugar beets looked like. And I got to see how we grew, you know, sunflower in the Dakotas, or how cattle was raised in Colorado. And so I could say, you know, optics kind of opened my eyes up to be a little bit more out the box, you know, thinker around different practices and cultivars and how we are, you know. We had to always acknowledge that we have to evolve. We have to be flexible. We have to pivot. We have to always understand that, you know, as producers, we can't just do what we did 20 or 30 years ago. And so that's one thing I love about the industry. Every farmer and rancher I've ever met is an entrepreneur. They evolve in their space, not allow their space to, you know, challenge them.
That's great. Can we talk about the mission of AgriCenter International? You know, what is the focus? I mean, just the fact that it's a 1,000-acre urban farm is mind-blowing enough, but I'm curious, what are the outcomes that you're looking to get from that?
Sure. So our mission is to advance the knowledge and understanding of agriculture. And so we do that through a lot of different lenses, and some of it's very, very intentional, and some of it is not so intentional. And let me give you an example of that. So we'll host, you know, like I said, a little over maybe 1.5 million, 1.6 million people. Some of those folks are here, has nothing to do with the industry. They're coming for a wedding maybe that we hosted on Saturday, you know, or they're coming for some type of show experience. But while they're here, they'll stop by a farmer's market and they'll visit our, you know, producers, or they'll take a walk on our trail and they'll see educational signage around the industry talking about the importance and economic development of soybeans or corn or cattle or cotton in the region. And so we also have, you know, trainings. We have a commercial kitchen. We have canning classes through extension, everything you can think of from A to Z. And so because we have so many resources here on campus, so we have about 40 companies that are located here. Our county extension service is located here through UT and Tennessee State University. We also have several other resources that are here, Tennessee Department of Agriculture, Farm Service Agency, NRCS. And so it's really an opportunity for both consumers and producers to connect. So part of what we really say is this is where urban meets rural. And so we don't look at it's either or. We look at being the place, that melting pot where not only conversations, but also information can be, you know, traded back and forth, because we can't live in a bubble anymore. You know, we don't live just in our isolated area. And I think one of the things we've learned over the last couple of decades as producers, we have to be actively communicating about our story. And if we're not doing that, somebody else is telling that story for us, and more likely or most likely, they're telling it inaccurately to meet their, you know, own agenda. And so producers have to be actively communicating these stories. And so a lot of what we do is that we help tell that story. A couple of months ago, we hit over 2 million reaches on social media. So we're a very small nonprofit. And I would say, you know, probably nobody in the country has, with our resources, have, you know, 2 million reaches. And so we do that because we know that that's super important. And we try to offer as many of those stories up about the industry that we can, because we want people to hear and listen and experience. Sometimes it's just about, you know, telling a story. Sometimes it's just as easy as come, you know, smell this or taste this. So we do a You Pick Strawberry Patch, and you'd think, well, it's just 2 acres of strawberries, but, you know, people are out there experiencing something they've never experienced before. And, you know, if you haven't had a fresh strawberry, or you hadn't had fresh sweet corn, or you haven't had that experience, you don't know what you're missing. And so we try to connect those things.
I was curious, you had said, made this great statement before about turning conversation into practice. And I was wondering if you had an example from the farm where you've seen that conversation that you've had with an individual who's learning something new and that turns into practice or into something bigger out in the world?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of us know this story. We have to do more than just talk the talk. We have to walk the walk. And I'm as guilty as that as anybody, you know. But one of the things that I've really enjoyed in my career is, you know, I try to be a very active listener. And in that process, I believe that we can all find common ground. And even if I think I know what the best idea is, sometimes, you know, the old adage is I grew up right across from the Missouri boot hill. And sometimes you just have to show me, you know, so the show me state, you understand that analogy. But, you know, I was not sure early in my career that no-till cotton could be successful. So we no-tilled a lot, but we tend to, you know, starting out on our farm, we tended not to no-till cotton because if you understand what cotton has to have a warm soil to be able to germinate. And it's a little more sensitive than what corn or soy is, or even milo. And so we didn't start no-tilling cotton until probably mid-90s, probably 95, 96. We would always try to work the soil up. And so we tend to only be able to plant cotton on certain farms because of erosion. And so what we were able to do with really taking that challenge of how do we no-till cotton and still have planting dates, you know, where we need them and et cetera. And basically we worked with our extension agent to figure all that out. But I was not an early adopter in that area. How about that? So I got taught a few lessons and I listened and I learned. And now all the cotton we plant is no-till. So that's a great example of just, you know, understanding that we don't know everything and we're constantly evolving around a lot of these spaces because of the tools that are in our toolbox. So you have to say, I can't farm the way I farm today if I had the same tools I had in the 80s. So what's allowing me this flexibility is the chemistries that we have, the fertilizers that we have, the equipment that we have, you know, our ability to work literally 24 hours a day. You know, I mean, I remember the lights we had on tractors in the early to mid 80s versus now, you know, we can see for miles. And so, you know, just give me a week, I can plant everything, you know, I mean, so we can punch through a lot of our challenges because of the tools we have. So that's one example.
So, Tim, we haven't had a cotton farmer on this podcast before, have we?
I don't think so. No.
I don't think so. So I'm super curious, what was it in the mid 90s that allowed you to go, you know, cotton and tillage that year to no-till cotton? What was the set of tools that made the big difference?
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of things. If you remember what was going on in the, you know, mid 90s is we were just getting Roundup technology. We were getting a lot of integration. So we had BT cotton. So we weren't as worried about, you know, maybe, you know, planting into a cover crop where it might be an insect trap. We could control them better and all the cool things that we've learned versus what we thought we knew, you know. And so there is a lot of breaking down of traditional stereotypes, you know, and there are some legitimate challenges, you know, as you start to transition. And so we didn't start out with, you know, 1,000 acres, say if we were going to have 1,000 acres of cotton that year, we didn't start out with doing 1,000 acres the first year. You know, we kind of leaned our way into it, you know, starting out with 100 or 250 or something like that. And so the challenge was understanding the practice and then applying that practice to that particular farm. And it's a little bit different. So as soil types change, so does the practice. So does what, you know, your management criteria for that particular farm. And so because of the diversity, you know, we have everything from Memphis and Phyllaea type soils to Robertson and Grenada soils. And so it's a lot of variability in those soil types, a lot of different, you know, components, whether it's sand or clay. And so very rich soils, all very successful soils, but you had to manage them a little differently. So what we learned over the years is that, you know, by reducing our tillage, we were able to save moisture. We waited a little bit because we wanted the soil to warm up, but we also were able to, you know, terminate the cover crop and manage the cover crops a little better with some of the tools, whether it's a chemistry or a mechanical tool. And all those things have led to some tremendous success. So I remember farming when our average yields for cotton was, you know, a bale or maybe 600 pounds an acre. And now if we pick less than two bale, we're like mad at ourselves, you know. Same thing for soybeans. I remember our goal was to raise 40 bushel soybeans. Now if we're under 60, we think we've had a difficult year. And so all these things have evolved and changed, and we're better. And then better, smarter plant breeding, you know, we haven't even mentioned yet. And so, you know, some of those better tools are smarter plants. And it may not be biotechnology. It may not be a genetically modified plant. It may just be a better plant that's been bred to be more successful in our environment or in our climate. And so all these things have added to our success over the years as producers.
With all that technology and those developments that you mentioned, that evolution, how has your cover crop program or your cover crop approach changed to what it is today, both on your home farm and at AgriCenter International?
Yeah, so we've learned a lot with the variety, the species of cover crops. We've also learned, you know, about adding different types of tillage crops, whether it's a turnip or a radish, into the mix. We started out, the first cover crop we had was veg. And again, you know, I think that just created an opportunity to learn from that experience. You know, we've also done a lot of clovers. So we've added some legumes to mixes to, you know, fix some of our own nitrogen and to save on the cost of adding a synthetic fertilizer, you know, back to the soil. And as our input costs have continued to rise, all these things make us more profitable. And so you have to understand at the end of the day, yes, we want to be a wonderful, you know, manager of our natural resources, but we also are operating a business, and that business has to be successful. And so there has to be a profit at the end of the day, hopefully, God willing. So, you know, even though a lot of people refer to their farms or their farming family members as small business men and women, and I love that label, I'll take that any day, they're pretty large P&Ls. And so our farms have evolved and changed over the last, you know, 25 to 30 years. I think it's partly because of necessity to afford the new equipment, you know, to afford the new practices. You have to have so many acres to run a combine or a picker over. And so, you know, that it's just forced us. And then also, as people have gotten out of farming, less people have wanted to get in. And so the number of farmers has shrunk. Obviously, the age of farmers continues to rise. I'm a product of that myself. And so, you know, I think all those things have led us to where we're at. But it also means that there's a ton of opportunity for us in the future. So we will have to continue to evolve. Technology is changing the space significantly. And I think technology will also enhance our ability to be more successful with cover crops as well. We'll learn more. We'll have better tools in the toolbox. And, you know, on the AgriCenter research plot last year, we flew fungicide with the drone over our corn crop. You know, are you kidding me? We flew an unmanned vehicle and applied fungicide to tasseling corn with a drone. I mean, I don't know if I would have said that 5 years ago. I don't know if I'd even would have known to have said that 5 years ago. So it's a pretty cool space. You know, we're evolving significantly.
And can you talk more about the research, the type of research that you all choose to do? You know, I think that's really cool with fungicide on corn, but what other research are you focused on, and how do you kind of make the decision of what to focus on? Because it sounds like you're in an area that you could pretty much attack about anything.
Yeah. So first, there's two different programs we use. So we have a CRO, a commercial research organization, where we contract with a partner. So we have a lot of third-party partners that come in and contract with us to do a protocol on a particular product. It could be plant, it could be chemistry, it could be some type of fertilizer, it could be some type of biological product, humus product, it could be anything under the sun. Or it could be a practice. It could be, you know, irrigation versus dry land versus seeding rate. So it could be a practice model, or it could be some type of combination of all those things. So that's one thing. And we'll almost look at anything. Now, granted, it has to have a certain type of approval process through, you know, local, federal, and state agencies. But as long as it meets that guideline, we're happy to evaluate a product. And so we handle all those things. And it could be from a country halfway around the world. We had about 80 companies last year from 14 different countries that did research here, right here in Memphis, Tennessee. And most of those countries flew in at some point in time to evaluate their product or flew in with their sales team or their dealer network or whatever. And so we're very happy to do that. And we're always excited to partner with new teams. The other model I mentioned, I said we had two. One is a CRO. The other model is research that we lead ourselves. So I mentioned we have the South's largest hop yard. And so we grow hops here. We have seven different varieties that we have looked at just because we want to understand how those varieties, you know, work with our soil, work with our humidity, work with our temperatures. And so we do both of a yield analysis and a quality analysis on those. But we also look at almonds, we look at other fruit trees, peaches and pears, and we look at brambles. And so we have a lot of that type of proprietary research that's led by the nonprofit and then given back to the industry. So that information is published and it's available to producers, you know, anywhere to try to identify, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And so we look at that as part of our mission.
Earlier, you said, from you getting to take over farming in your 20s, you kind of wanted to give that to the next generation, which I think is a unique and selfless decision to do that. Why was that important to you? And how did you know the time was right?
Yeah. Wow. That's two great questions. Thank you for putting me on the spot there, Tim. First, I think I mentioned that my father did it for me, and I wanted to make sure that next generation. So my mother and father were very clear that my goal as a steward over those resources was temporary. And I certainly understand that, you know, we all have a finite number of days and we have no idea what that is. And we want to make sure we are the best steward that we can be of those natural resources. And so I was always going to try to find a transition. Timing of that was really unique. Basically, I had a son that was out of college looking for something to do, and he was a great cattleman. He was a really good cattle guy, and so he always had a passion for animals. And then, you know, we had a couple other folks that were around doing other things, and so it was just an easy transition. You know, not all things are known. You think you know what you know, but you only know it when you experience it. So there was a little bit of self-discovery for everybody in that process, you know. What does success look like? I don't know. I'm not the person to tell other people how to do that. I'm the person to say, here's what I experienced. And, you know, at first it starts with a conversation and then it's probably 1,000 conversations after that to get the right balance. But it'll all work out at the end because it has to.
Well, John, as we close here, you know, listening in is an audience of other farmers that are at differing points in their soil health journey. You know, I want to give you the last word. Any message that you would share with those individuals, you know, trying to find what might work in their own operation, or any message you want to emphasize that we've talked about here today?
Yeah, first and foremost, I'm not an expert in anything. I'm just like you. I'm a farmer. I'm a rancher. I love what I do, and I know you love what you do. The only thing I would try to encourage you to do as a manager of those natural resources to make sure that you're following a path that leads toward the ultimate success of your organization. I wish you the best. You know, I think about all of us every day and how much we spend to create, you know, a better life for so many people. And I have a ton of respect for that. So thank you for what you do. And I encourage you to investigate if you're not, you know, maybe somebody that has ever dealt with no-till or ever dealt with cover crops. I would encourage you to reach out to Land Grant University in your area or to the extension agent in your area or to Farmers for Soil Health and find out what tools are in your toolbox and what's available for you. There's a lot of resources out there. And I think we're going to continue to find more and more people that are, you know, I guess you'd say, inviting us in for the first time. And I think it's fine. It doesn't matter whether you've been here a year or one day or 10 years, you know, we're all learning. So we're all still students. We're a student every day. I get taught lessons every day. And some of them are pretty painful, I assure you, but some of them are pretty fun too. So that's just the way it goes.
Well, what a neat story there of some super exciting things happening in Memphis. Thank you very much to John Butler for taking the time to be on the show today. I should also mention that John believes every city and region should have something like AgriCenter, and I definitely agree with him. What a cool opportunity for research and outreach and education. You can learn more about AgriCenter International on their website, which is just agricenter.org, and I'll leave a link for that in the show notes for you as well. Before we close, I'd like to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show was produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayuette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe to and follow this show on your favorite podcast app, and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Also, be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website at farmersforsoilhealth.com. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.